From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Happy Bike to Work Day.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Muriel Bowser, mayor of the District of Columbia. But first, joining us in studio now is Ralph Northam. He is Virginia's lieutenant governor and a Democratic candidate for governor. Dr. Northam, Governor Northam, Ralph Northam. Ralph, welcome.
Thank you, Kojo. And Kojo, I did want to let you know that Tom was the moderator of our first debate. He did a great job, and he made you proud. So I wanted to let you know that firsthand.
We were aware of this, and we were aware that he did a good job. We were frankly surprised by that.
In our current world of news, that's ancient history. We got to move on to more important things. We only have him for about 27 minutes, though, today.
In that case, if you'd like to join the conversation, call now, 800-433-8850. You can follow our live stream on Facebook Live or at our website, kojoshow.org. Send us email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Let's start with the polls. According to the Washington poll released yesterday, this race is tight. Your Democratic opponent, Tom Perriello, according to that poll, is in the lead. What do you make of the latest numbers, and what are you focusing on in the remaining 3 weeks before the primary?
Well, we saw that poll, Kojo, and we have some internal polling that's a little bit different, but you know, the most important poll was on June the 13th, so we're working very hard, traveling around the Commonwealth, listening to people, seeing what's on their minds. They certainly, the economy, wanting a job that they can support themselves and their families with is important. Access to health care, access to a world-class education for their children, living in safe communities. So we're doing a lot of listening and talking about our experience in Richmond over the last 10 years, the things that we've stood for and fought for. So we feel confident. Again, it's a tight race, but we're looking at June 13th. That's the most important poll to us.
Is okay. Your confidence boosted by the fact that turnout for off-year primaries is typically low and only around 10%, and that the demographic that tends to go to the polls reliably, older voters seem to be heavily in your camp?
Well, I think there's a lot of enthusiasm across the Commonwealth, Kojo, so I think we're expecting a little bit higher turnout. You know, there's a lot of anti-Washington, anti-Trump sentiment out there. People are coming up saying, what can I do? How can I get involved? And so I think there's a lot of energy, and we'll see those people coming to the polls on Election Day. So we want to make sure that we reach out to everybody.
Let's say what the numbers are, and just to be fair to George Mason University, it's the Schar School, which also did the poll with the Post. 40% for Mr. Perriello, 38% for you. That's statistically even. 20% undecided. But what's key in the poll that I saw is that here in Northern Virginia, where the race could be won or lost, one-third of the voters are undecided. That's a lot more than 20%. Mr. Perriello has tried to make this a national race with Bernie Sanders' endorsement of him, Elizabeth Warren, saying he'll stand up to Donald Trump. You have been more traditional middle conservative Democrat saying, let's continue the progress we've made under McAuliffe, Tim Kaine, Mark Warner. Is this a national race, and is that the way people should see it?
Well, we certainly appreciate the attention that Virginia's receiving. This is the bellwether, I believe, for the country. People are paying a lot of attention to what happens in Virginia, especially after what we watched in 2016. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is about Virginia, Tom. I mean, it's about getting out, doing grassroots work. It's about having relationships, experience in Richmond. And, you know, we're very proud that folks like Governor McAuliffe and Tim Kaine and Mark Warner and the Virginia congressmen, Virginia state senators who are Democrats and delegates who are Democrats have, you know, had unwavering support from me. So So we're confident about that, and we think that bodes well for us on June the 13th.
Some people are characterizing that support versus the support that Tom Perriello has received as populism versus the establishment. Do you endorse that characterization?
You know, Kojo, I think if you're going to use the word establishment, let's talk about Virginia establishment versus national establishment. And so this is a Virginia race, and I don't really like to use that term, but I look at it as someone that has been in Virginia politics for 10 years, which I have, which I've stood up and fought for, you know, progressive democratic values. And I think people in Virginia will recognize that and appreciate that this, at the end of the day, is a race about Virginia.
Yeah, I just want to mention, in 2014, Anthony Brown was a lieutenant governor, I believe, and he ran for governor of Maryland. He had across-the-board endorsements, but lost, and ran a kind of a lackluster.
And he did win the Democratic primary.
He won the primary, but lost to Larry Hogan, a Republican in a very blue state. And that's where some people think this anti-establishment thing is coming, that you can be criticized for being experienced.
You know, I use the analogy, Tom. It's you know, if you have to go see the neurosurgeon, you'd just as soon have someone that has experience, that's been there before, and that's the same way it is. And I think in public policy in Virginia, and I have that experience.
I'm surprised in this raw. This is the politics hour. I got to say it first. on the NRA, Perriello's A-plus rating or A-minus, whatever it was, rating for the NRA, and his abortion stances, which are two powerful things that he has to fight. I'm surprised you haven't brought it up even more. And I'm just thinking, in the last 3 weeks, with your advantage in fundraising and the organization, is it going to be a pretty tough 3 weeks? Am I going to see a lot of ads and different things on these two particular issues in him?
You know, one of the good things I think about our party in Virginia, Tom, is we are civil, and Tom and I have agreed to run a positive campaign. And I think, to your point, there are some significant contrast differences between the two of us, and one of them is our records on women's choice. I have been unwavering as being pro-choice. And regarding the common sense gun control, I have a D rating. I'm actually the only candidate running for governor that's never had an A rating. So there's a large difference between the two of us. And, you know, when we talk about progressive democratic values, I'm proud of, standing up for responsible gun ownership and have the endorsements of folks that believe in the same things that I do.
Well, in the recent debate this past Tuesday in Norfolk, some sparks did fly, in particular over taxes. Where do you and your opponent part ways on the issue of taxes?
Well, I don't know all the details, Kojo, of his tax plan, but I do know ballpark figures that he's looking at a $1 billion tax increase in Virginia, which it's just having been there for 10 years. We have a Republican-controlled House and Senate right now, and I think we have to be realistic. So I believe in forming a commission for tax reform that will look at certain things, especially like getting rid of the grocery tax, which is a very regressive tax in Virginia that hurts people of low income. So those are the things that I'm working toward, and I want a tax reform system that is fair and that's progressive and simple in Virginia. And as a business owner, and I started my business back in 96, I'm very aware of our tax code, and we need to be competitive with other states. At the end of the day, the Commission for Tax Reform will be something that presents a plan that's bipartisan. It will have to have people from both sides of the aisle to agree on it, and then it will finally be signed by the governor. So, again, I've been around the block in Virginia. I know how to get things done, and I know what's possible, and I think that's important for the voters to know.
John Whitbeck of Loudoun County runs the Republican Party of Virginia. I was speaking to him this week. There was some rumor, false rumor, it turned out, that Corey Stewart, the candidate, was going to drop out. I won't name the TV station that was wrong, but it wasn't mine. But John Whitbeck says that you guys, meaning you and Tom Perriello, are laying out a too-far-left progressive agenda, and he mentions the $15 minimum wage as an example, that will help Republicans. Now, he didn't say this, but it looks like Ed Gillespie's going to be the nominee. He's a moderate, conservative, middle-of-the-road person, at least that's his campaign. Are you concerned at all that this race to counter Tom Perriello on your left is going to hurt you whoever the nominee is going forward against the Republicans?
No, I think it's a great question, Tom. But, you know, I was traveling around Virginia right now and watching what's going on in Washington with health care, with what the funding that has been threatened to be taken away from our cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay. There's just a tremendous amount of energy and enthusiasm, and I think this bodes well for our party, not only to pick up the governor's, attorney general, and lieutenant governor seats, but also to pick up a lot of delegate seats. And so if we could do that, have a very strong coordinated campaign, which I'll work on after the primary, it'd be great for us as a party to get back on offense and stop playing defense in Virginia.
Dominion Energy is building two natural gas pipelines in Virginia. You have said they should go through a strict environmental review. You have not, however, opposed them. A recent Washington Post article suggests that your neutrality on this issue is strategic. Dominion has some 76,000 employees in Virginia. They got a letter from their chief executive urging them to vote, but many Virginians would like to hear you come down on one side or the issue of the issue or another. Do you think this project is good for Virginia or not? And if it is good, who benefits?
Well, my position is realistic, Kojo, and there are things that we can do from a regulatory point of view at the state level. We have the DEQ, which I have worked with. Department of Environmental Quality.
Oh, thank you very much.
No
problem. Sounded like Dairy Queen to me.
No. But, you know, I've been working with them to establish a what we call a site-specific permitting process versus a blanket permit. So we want to make sure if the pipeline moves forward that it's done with transparency and science. So I have done everything that I can working through our regulatory process. At the end of the day, and this is really what Virginians need to know, this is an interstate project. It comes from West Virginia through Virginia into North Carolina, and FERC, which is a federal agency, will make the final decision. So for anybody to want to usurp the regulatory process that we have in place to go around that, I think sends a bad message to the business community, and it's certainly not a position that the lieutenant governor or the governor should take. So we want it done with transparency and science. We want it done making sure that we respect people's property rights. But at the end of the day, if those things are in place and FERC decides that they want to move forward with it, the pipeline will move forward in Virginia.
There are those who do not trust FERC. Put on your headphone, please, because you'll explain that in a second, because that is what Lauren in Richmond, Virginia, wants to talk about. Lauren, what is FERC?
Thank you so much for allowing me to speak on your show, Kojo, and thank you so much to the Lieutenant Governor for answering our questions. I just wanted to note that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has been presented with numerous pipelines over the decades that it's been tasked with regulating these pipelines, and it has approved every single one except for one. And a lot of the funding for the commission actually comes from industry partners and actually comes from the profit that they make off of building those natural gas pipelines. And due to its history and its neglect of people's demands for better support in litigating for environmental protections through those processes, through offices that have been approved by Congress. Due to that history, I wanted to know, Lieutenant Governor, if you honestly think that FERC is better prepared to defend Virginians or better situated to defend Virginians than the Office of the Governor. And if...
Okay, allow me to have him respond.
Well, Lauren, thank you for the question. And again, it goes back to what I was saying. FERC, I don't have any control, nor does our governor, over how they make their decisions. We have control over our regulatory processes that are already in place. And that, as I've just described or explained to you, was through the DEQ. So we're doing everything that we can at the state level. I don't have influence over FERC, and so we need to be realistic with people and know that at the end of the day, it's going to be FERC that makes that decision, not Virginia, not the governor, not the DEQ. So that's the reality.
We got an email from Boyd who said, you've built a long-term relationship with Dominion Energy, have been taking close to $100,000 since 2008, including $20,000 this cycle. You've also had private meetings with Dominion that you refuse to talk about. How can we trust you to make decisions about Virginia's energy future?
Well, first of all, there have been no private meetings with Dominion, and I'm not sure where that came from. I think the other thing is that that Virginians need to be aware of is that I make my decisions based on what's in the best interest of Virginia, not from which corporations give contributions. And I think you can look at my record standing up against the tobacco industry. I'm the one that patroned and passed the legislation to ban smoking in restaurants. I have been the first statewide elected that spoke out against offshore drilling. So I've taken on a lot of big corporations and businesses, to include the NRA. We mentioned that earlier. I'm the only one that does not have an A rating from the NRA, and I've stood up for responsible gun ownership. So at the end of the day, Kojo, and I hope people look at my record, I have proposed campaign finance reform, which will start by not taking contributions from big businesses, and it will limit contributions from individuals to $10,000. I have led that effort in healthcare as well. I don't even take a writing pen from pharmaceutical companies. I would love to see us take that direction in politics, but the first thing that needs to happen, Kojo and Tom, is that we need to have nonpartisan redistricting. We need to draw our lines fairly in Virginia, get rid of the gerrymandering, and then we can deal with some of these issues like campaign finance reform.
I just want to wrap up the pipeline issue. Are you don't have a personal view? You're a person outdoors and all these other things. You don't have a personal view, and you're just looking at this coldly as a governing issue that the governor can't do much to stop this pipeline? Couldn't your energy department delay it or require more investigation? Or can this Federal Energy Commission just roll over the state and say they're going to be built regardless?
You know, Tom, I have faith and confidence in our DEQ. We have oversight of that.
Department of Environmental Quality.
That's
Thank
right.
You.
Not the Dairy Queen.
Thank you.
And as I said earlier, I've done everything I can to work with them and make sure that this is done environmentally responsibly, and we do it with property rights owners' considerations as well. So that's what we can do in Virginia. That's the reality of it. And at the end of the day, the FERC will make the final decision.
Got to ask about roads. Can I ask about roads now? We're talking to our Northern Virginia audience. Some of them are probably sitting on I-66 somewhere. Governor McAuliffe, every governor has come along and done something about roads, but we're growing into a bigger problem rather than growing out of it. Any thoughts for the people who are trying to get to work or see their families or go shopping in Northern Virginia?
Well, as you just mentioned, I-66, and we have a plan on the table, a proposal to expand I-66. And so, you know, we had
a bigger parking lot. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's the feeling.
Which was leading me, Kojo, to the point that we do have new resources coming into Virginia because of our transportation plan from 2013. But another issue that I think is as important as roads in Northern Virginia and here in Washington is the metro system. And that is vitally important to the economy, and we need to make sure that Virginia, Maryland, and Washington are at the table on a regional basis and do what's in the best interest of these folks up here. And that's going to take leadership, by the way. We're going to need to take a plan to the General Assembly and bring people to the table and say, you know what, Northern Virginia carries a lot of water for the Commonwealth, very important to our economy, and we need to step up to the plate and make sure that at the appropriate time when there's a dedicated source of revenue for Metro, Virginia's going to be there.
Well, at this point, Virginia is lagging way behind in the idea. I mean, Virginia has a great deal of economic interest in Metro, but it says you have to fix your house before we give you any more money, and that's a downward spiral. That's not going to happen. It's getting worse, not better. Do you think there ought to be some federal control board over Metro like there was over the city, which turned the District of Columbia around?
Well, I think it'd be nice to have the federal government help out with Metro. I'm not sure if that's going to happen with what's going on in Washington right now. But to your point, Tom, there are some issues with management of Metro. There's some safety issues. There's some issues with how to fund it. And Virginia has taken the position and Terry McAuliffe, our governor, has asked for an oversight committee to kind of take direction on how we deal with the Metro. But
Mr. LaHood is doing a million-dollar review of what to do.
That's right, and he's going to bring his recommendations to us. And again, when we see that there are improvements are made, then we'll be at the table.
We got a tweet from Beck, who would like the Lieutenant Governor to weigh in on the removal of Confederate statues in New Orleans and the options for Richmond.
It's a great question, and, you know, we believe that these parts of history should be in museums and not out where they're divisive. And so we've done things, Kojo, like taking the Confederate flag off of license plates in Virginia, which we were able to do, and we were very proud of that. As you know, we've restored the rights of over 156,000 Virginians that were felons, and we're very proud of that. As far as these statues and roads, we've dealt with this over the past couple of years, and we feel it's a local issue, and so we'll certainly be supportive of what they want to do. For example, in Charlottesville right now. At the end of the day, though, it should be local. But, you know, Kojo, we pride ourselves in Virginia on being inclusive. We live in a very diverse society. So, you know, things that are divisive, that cause hard feelings, we really can't go in that direction. And quite frankly, I think the rest of the story needs to be told. Those leaders of our civil rights over the years, let's talk about some statues and naming roads after them, because that's an important part of our history as well.
Ralph Northam is Virginia's lieutenant governor. He's a Democratic candidate for governor. Here now is Dan in Vienna, Virginia. Dan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question relates to taxes, a discussion you were having earlier. And I'm going to do some a little bit of California bashing. I love California, but I hate their taxes. And as a small business owner, I'm thinking about the California franchise tax, which I call a predatory tax, because you have to pay the minimum franchise tax of about $800. That's the minimum that you pay in a year. If you do $1 of business, if you earn $1 of income from California sources, I think that's unfair. Virginia doesn't have a predatory tax like that against Californians. What do you do about that as governor?
Well, Dan, I appreciate the question. Here's the deal. At the end of the day, we need to have a tax code in Virginia that's competitive with other states. You know, we've worked very hard, when I say we, our governor and attorney general, on building the new Virginia economy. We've brought in over 190,000 new jobs to Virginia. Our unemployment rate has gone from 5.4% to 3.8%. It's the lowest that it's been in 9 years. And I can just tell you, when we reach out and help businesses grow in Virginia and also want to attract new businesses and manufacturers, a competitive tax code is very important. So this is why, you know, our code in Virginia is a bit antiquated. It's complicated. It's cumbersome. So one of the things that I want to do is to establish a commission to look and make sure that it's progressive, that it's simple, and it's fair, and also that it's competitive with other states. Because if we're not competitive with other states, businesses are going to go elsewhere, and we desperately need to continue to build our economy, and we want to attract people that come to Virginia, not that want to go to other states.
Dan, thank you for your call.
You and Mr. Perriello, I think, deserve credit for the number of debates that you've had around the state, Norfolk, Roanoke, here in Northern Virginia. I think your last joint appearance is tomorrow, the 20th, I don't even know what today's date is.
Today's the 19th.
Okay, I think May 20th might be your last one, but you probably don't know your schedule. It's so crazy. But, again, we'll be down to the last few weeks. You said you both have said you'd want to run positive campaigns, but this is a get-out-the-vote time. This is your last appeal to people, Democrats particularly, to come out and vote for you. What will we see in these last 3 weeks? You have enough money for a pretty good television campaign around the state. What will those ads say?
Well, they'll say that, number one, that I'm a fighter and that I'll stand up to what's going on in Washington, just the recklessness and the hatred that we're seeing coming out of Washington. We know that that's very important in Virginia. We'll also talk about someone that's fought for 10 years since he's been in public service for progressive democratic values, who's helped the economy in Virginia. And we'll also talk about experience, because that's important. Someone that knows how to get things done in Virginia. The smoking ban in restaurants is a good example of that.
But the country's mood is, let's fight back, particularly on the Democratic side. Let's fight back. Let's a new wave of optimism and progressivism and populism and bash Trump and make ourselves feel good. Isn't that going to be part of the campaign?
Absolutely.
And you called him a maniac? What's his phrase?
Well, I used a medical term, narcissistic.
narcissistic mean, yeah.
Yes. Well, we want it to be medically correct. But, you know, we will fight. And people know that I'll stand up to him. But we also need to talk about Virginia, too, and how to move Virginia forward, how to make sure that everybody in Virginia has a good, high-paying job. These are the things that are important to Virginians.
We got a Facebook live stream question from Kaylee. Curious about why the lieutenant governor voted for George Bush twice. He commented that, quoting here, he didn't pay much attention to politics, which sounds like a cop-out response. Does he side with the GOP on many issues now?
Well, the answer is look at my record, Kojo, and I have been unwavering on progressive democratic values. And just as the caller said, I was underinformed during that time. I was building my medical practice, doing pediatric hospice work, and knowing what I know now, he doesn't line up with my values, and I wouldn't have voted for him. But I would tell you that at the end of the day, Kojo, I think something that Virginia needs to hear, which is not always told, when I was asked that question, nobody knew who I voted for in the booth, and I could have danced around the answer or I could have not told the truth, but my honor is very important to me, and I did tell the truth, and Virginians need to know that I will continue to tell the truth, and that's the kind of leader that they need and expect.
Here's Barbara in Alexandria, Virginia. Barbara, your turn.
Thank you, Kojo. I really appreciate the chance to learn a little bit more about the lieutenant governor. My family and I live in Fairfax, the Alexandria part, and I'm a proud Democrat living in a very diverse part of the state. So I think my comment is I really appreciate, as the mother of an 11-year-old who I took to Congressman Don Beyer's town hall, that everybody acted like adults, and I was able to show her for one of the first times in recent memory that democracy really can happen. So thank you to both of you for running a clean, civil, positive campaign. Talk about what Democrats can do. Honestly, I will vote for whomever the Democratic candidate is. I want to keep Virginia under a Democratic governor.
I'll finish that for you, Barbara, and may the best person win. That's about all the time we have. Ralph Northam, thank you so much for joining.
We're going to end on a positive note.
I was trying to do that.
What about our reputation as journalists?
I was trying to do that, but I know that is a betrayal of your reputation. Ralph Northam is Virginia's lieutenant governor. He's a Democratic candidate for governor. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Kojo and Tom. It's always great to be on your show, and hope you all have a great weekend.
And everybody vote on, or every Democrat vote.
It's the Politics Hour. Our next guest is Muriel Bowser. She is the mayor of the District of Columbia. If you have questions or comments for her, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can watch our live stream on Facebook, or you can watch the live stream on our website, kojoshow.org. You can send us a tweet at kojoshow. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Tom Sherwood, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, has officially resigned effective June 30th, and a lot of residents of the district, especially those who are advocates of voting rights, will say that, oh, this is a good thing, but the replacement of Jason Chaffetz, it's likely to be any different.
Well, there's a whole series of people, Democrat or Republican, I might add, who
Craig
come up
Gowdy and South Carolina, Jim Jordan.
Right, it's a long list.
Freedom Member Caucus.
Some are more friendly, Tom Davis. Some are not. But here's the point: whoever is on that committee, under the Constitution, Congress has full legislative authority over the district, but they have a moral obligation, whomever it is to learn the city over which they can rule so easily. They ought to get out beyond the Congress. They ought to get out beyond the Capitol and the National Mall and the White House and see the real city where real people live. And then when they make decisions, I feel better about it. That's the way the Constitution is set up. But when they rule from on high and sleep in their offices and don't know Bladensburg Road from Bethesda, well, then I think we need to just challenge them to either get involved with the city or keep your hands off. Now, I've just answered that question for the mayor.
Well, you have answered the idealist. You have given the idealist approach to the issue.
American.
The American probably
give
a more realistic assessment of what's likely to happen. Mayor Bowser, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Thank you, Tom, for having me.
When Representative Chaffetz goes, what do you think will happen next as opposed to what Tom hopes will happen next?
Well, I tend to take the same view that we have to work with whoever is there, and we have to remind them to mind the federal issues that affect Washington, but leave the local issues to us. We were elected to pass the laws and execute the laws for Washington, D.C.
My view, of course, you know, is don't let the pond scum interloper dictators get you down. But that's a whole
I still have that button on my refrigerator.
That's a whole nother story. On to the issue of the day. An inspector general's report made public this week by the Washington Post describes how former school's chancellor Kaya Henderson placed children of several top administration officials in schools of their choice, allowing them to bypass the lottery system. Did the former school's chancellor abuse her authority to approve discretionary school transfers, and did any of these requests go through your office?
Well, let me just start off by saying, Kojo, that I want everybody listening to know that we take this issue very seriously. We recognize that parents across the city have participated in the process because each parent wants what's best and what they think is the best match for their child. So I am deeply sorry there's any doubt about the decisions that were made by any member of my team. But what I can assure all parents out there is that we will put systems in place to make sure that there's never a question about this chancellor's discretionary placement. Let me also say this, that we have a fair and robust lottery process, and that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is the chancellor's ability to make discretionary placements.
Tom? You know, we talked about this yesterday for my Channel 4 story, but since it's again being the politics hour, do you acknowledge that maybe you were a little slow to acknowledge the anger from the parents who were hearing about it? Each of these interventions by the chancellor maybe could have a reason that would be good or maybe not. But it was just the image that people of power had access that these parents don't have, and they have to depend on the lottery. Do you, just for political purposes, do you acknowledge that maybe you could have been a little bit more aggressive than you just were then, saying that this was should have been fixed earlier?
Well, actually,
because you got the information back in February.
We took action in February. So I want you to be clear about that. Chancellor Wilson started on February 1st, and he was advised then to be very mindful of this discretionary placement issue, that it was being questioned, and we wanted to move forward in a very transparent way. And since then, I know you know that I issued a mayor's order that, first of all, halts any placements until we have an internal DCPS policy.
30-day moratorium.
Yes, and Chancellor Wilson has already begun that, actually, before the mayor's order was issued. And we expect he is the educator here, and he has experience from other districts of how we can move forward with that. But beyond that, the internal policies that he will work on, I think that public officials, and I agree with any parent who has a question, that there should be no question about a public official cutting the line. And the way to do that is to make sure, and I am requiring the public officials who work for me to seek advice from the Independent Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. And in addition to that, the chancellor, before he makes any discretionary decisions, would also have to consult with the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. And I should say that the chancellor should approach this, and I know Chancellor Wilson agrees, that these should only be very unique circumstances where he would feel the need to use his discretionary
placement. Two responses. We got a tweet from Lisa who said, I've supported and voted for Mayor Bowser, but I don't think she or her cabinet get why the lottery story enrages so many people like me. And then there is Ronnie in Mount Pleasant. Tom Sherwood, put on your headphones, please. Ronnie, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call. As a parent, I understand how much getting into a high-performance school matters. I think the news coverage has overblown this a bit since the waiver process is legal and was hardly ever used. But I do want to know, Mayor Bowser, how can parents trust the lottery?
Well, let me say, Ronnie, as I tried to mention, this question has nothing to do with the lottery. The lottery is separate and apart from the chancellor's discretion, and in fact, is housed outside of DCPS entirely. What we are talking about is the regulation that allows the chancellor to make, in unique circumstances, a discretionary placement. So, quite frankly, we've stopped it. We are requiring Chancellor Wilson, and he is is up for the task and has already started the process of coming up with a set of rules. And in addition to that, making sure that a public official is checking in with the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability to make sure that nothing they're requesting violates our ethics, but also the chancellor would check in with the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability to have another check on his impartiality.
Thank you very much for your
call.
But
you started with the first caller, and I want to address
the first tweet.
I do get why people are angry. I get angry if I think somebody is jumping the line in front of me. And I recognize how important these school decisions are for families and the anxiety that goes with the decisions in the lottery placement process. And I want to ensure all the people out there that I am not happy about anybody having that view of our cabinet members, and we will change it.
Well, we also got an email from Sarah in Chevy Chase who writes, I think this is much ado about nothing. We are lucky to get some of these people working in our city, and if the chancellor and staff give a few discretionary waivers to the policy so the kids go to certain schools, I have no problem with it. And I'm a parent of DCPS students. I must say that I have heard over the weekend, and I don't know if this breaks down along racial lines because most of the people I heard it from over the weekend are African-American who had that identical view. Have you also heard that view expressed?
Well, I think that people recognize that the chancellor needs a set of guidelines. And if there's a set of guidelines, they recognize the chancellor may have to make a discretionary placement. But we should be able to explain why. And I deeply believe that it has to be focused on the particular needs of a child.
Tom Sherwood, is there a silver lining in this cloud? And that is there is so much brouhaha over getting into D.C. public schools?
Yes. Let me just say that the issue here is not the how many people have benefited from special treatment, but to who? And I still think the IG should release the full report so we can all see it. If you're in such a position as whatever position you have that you need special treatment, then in this system, I think it would help the integrity of the system just to put the report out there so we can see it. But the silver lining is, and I think the mayor would speak to this better than me, the schools are better physically, and the money, the billions of dollars I think the city has spent. The test scores are going up. The enrollments are going up.
Graduation rates are going up.
So that brings me to David Grosso, the chairman of the Education Committee, who just yesterday passed his budget for the coming year and said you had underfunded schools. He says the schools compared
there to— There goes that silver lining.
Yes, well, of course the silver lining is very thin always. But 2008, based on inflation, we now spend less than we did in 2008. And he raised the money for the schools permanently, he said.
Well, he may raise the money slightly.
A little, but not much. You had 1.5. Yes. You raised it to 2% yes. increase. His is 2.37.
Right, so.
A task force recommended 3.5. But the overall issue is we have a lot of young people. They're having babies. And some of them are deciding where their schools are going to go. Shouldn't the city have, as Grosso said, it's foot on the gas to make sure the schools are ready for them?
We absolutely have our foot on the gas when it comes to schools. And I want to acknowledge Council Member Grosso's efforts and all the members of the council who have stepped up to the plate on school reform for the last 10 years. And certainly this budget reflects a $100 million increase in our public education commitment over last year. And we did recognize,
that's
I will
like
say.
10% maybe, though. Isn't it a $1 billion school system? I don't know what the budget is.
Yes, over a billion.
Over a
between
billion
the
now.
Public charter schools right. and DCPS. Yeah. It's a pretty significant increase. We don't see other agencies in our city increasing at that level. But I think it's very important to note that we did recognize that we could do more as we went through the budget process and made that recommendation to the council to get the number up to 2%. And we've done 2% previously. My predecessors have done 2% previously. In some years, there's been no percentage increase. So we feel very strongly that we're putting the dollars in the schools to follow the students. Now, there was some question of whether some schools got cuts. And people should recognize that money in our system follows the student. So if the student's enrollment changes, then the budget for the school changes.
But let me just address that because in the Post story about this issue, they pointed out that Ballou, which is a fabulous new building, is losing some students and therefore losing money and therefore is having to cut maybe, I think, their English teacher and two or three teachers, when in fact we should be getting people to come to Ballou. And so if the population drops, shouldn't they still have all those special teachers and special aid for those students? And Wilson is busting at the seams, 1,700 students. It's going to cut some staff members because the increase doesn't cover their costs.
Well, Wilson actually has made the decision. We're trying to get the population at Wilson to be right-sized to the building.
Right.
So part of their budget, and that was supported, I believe, by the leadership at the school and the committee that supports the leadership, was to start reducing the population at Wilson. And I think it's almost 40 students, the slots that will be reduced at Wilson. And over the years, the population at Wilson will match the intended population per the building size. And so that means that there was less money in the budget. Now, I mentioned that we sent an additional $7 million to our budget request. So right now, in fact, Chancellor Wilson and I this afternoon will be going over what that $7 million can help with.
Mr. Grosso says that's the one-time funding, though.
Well, you know, we do a budget every year. And the next year, as I've committed, and it would be disingenuous for anyone to suggest otherwise, that we put that money in the budget and have every intention of maintaining it, which I've said repeatedly. But the bottom line for us right now, Tom, is Chancellor Wilson is looking at concerns that have been raised by schools. Certainly, we don't expect any teachers to be affected, unless sometimes, you know, schools, principals, they start making decisions about which staff to move forward with. And some of those, I'm sure, decisions are being made. But we will have the ability to allocate those additional dollars.
On to another issue. Here's Alan in Washington, D.C. Alan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mayor Bowser. I moved here in 1967 to attend Georgetown University, and I've been protesting in the streets for 50 years. But I've never seen or heard of an attack like the one that occurred at Sheridan Circle by the Turkish security guards.
Uh-oh, I don't know. I may have accidentally disconnected you, Alan, but we also got an email from Matt who says, please ask the mayor about the city's response to the violent, disgraceful, and illegal behavior of the Turkish officials at the Turkish embassy.
I got stuck in the horrible traffic there, and the police officers were very worried that it was going to expand.
Right. It was very difficult, and when I saw the footage from the scene, I think I may have been stuck in the same traffic. I was actually very nearby the incident, and I advised people to stay away from the scene. And what we saw, we had a peaceful demonstration. You know that our police know how to allow peaceful demonstrations to happen, and the peaceful demonstrators were attacked. And they were, like I agree with the caller, they were illegally attacked. Our police department will work with the federal agencies. I think Secret Service was also on the scene with the State Department to make sure that justice is delivered. And it is a different situation because we're dealing with foreign nationals. Some of them have diplomatic immunity. But our job at MPD is to protect our citizens and visitors, and we will do that.
It's an issue that we plan on looking at next week on this broadcast.
The State Department called in the Turkish ambassador, I think. And also, you can't maybe put these guys in prison or jail for what they did, but they can be deported and leave the country. And maybe the word go out to all the embassies that if you have visiting heads of state here, your security guards can't act like goons.
And there may be other options. And the chief of police is going to pursue the most aggressive approach that's available to us.
Can I ask a quick political question before you get started on anything else?
Are you going to be running again for office?
No,
in the next
already
election?
Said she's running again. Oh, okay. I have a more sophisticated question.
Let's hear them.
The council has moved the election next year up from September to June 19th, and all the primaries are going to be in June. I look back on your history, and you have a kind of a history of announcing for office about a year out. I'm thinking, you've already said you're going to run. When do you think you'll be, the summer, the fall? When are you going to formally announce, have your kickoff? You had it at your parents' home last time.
Why is that important?
It is important because Carl Racine, the Attorney General of the city, who sat right where she's sitting now, told us he would make his decision about running by the end of summer.
Thank you.
And we're getting towards the, you know, summertime.
Thank you. Sometimes you have to explain the importance
well,
of these things.
Like DQE
Your turn,
or whatever.
Madam Mayor.
Well, I'll be talking to you about that soon.
Oh, that's news.
Look forward to your budget proposal.
Kodjo, that's news. Soon
yes,
is news.
We're making a note of that. Our news department is
I'm going to tweet it right now
where
you're talking about another subject.
Your budget proposal included $100 million in tax cuts, which were written into D.C. law, but some council members and others have suggested those cuts should be pushed back to address areas like school funding. There's a pushback against the pushback coming from others, including former Mayor Anthony Williams, who heads the Federal City Council, the D.C. Chamber of Commerce, and others. But what is your response?
Well, you know that there was a tax review commission. It was chaired by Ed Lazier and Tony Williams, and it included many stakeholders. They met for 18 months, and after 18 months, they delivered a package of proposals. They agreed on some things that moved forward and some things didn't move forward. But the package that was moved forward was presented to the council. I voted on the package in 2014, and we had a banner year in Washington, D.C., I'm proud to say, last year, where we saw our revenues go up. We have people moving here, businesses moving here, a record year for tourism in the District of Columbia. And because of those additional revenues, we were able to advance the tax package sooner. This will be, next year, will be the first budget that I present that is not actually reduced by these tax triggers. And so I feel strongly that there has been a wide consensus for moving these tax breaks forward. And let me remind everybody that more than 60% of those changes affects middle and low income Washingtonians. So at the end of the year, they will have more money to spend on housing, to spend on the necessities of life in D.C.
On to Zachary in Woodley Park. Zachary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. So Mayor Bowser, 6 weeks ago on April 7th, the D.C. Universal Paid Leave Amendment Act of 2016 became law. So it's now the law of the land in the district. And I just wanted to ask your views on this. So Section 102 of the law says that the mayor shall establish the paid leave program to administer the benefits, and that within 180 days after the effective date of this act, the mayor shall issue rules to implement the provisions of this act. And so 180 days from April 7th is October 4th of this year. So my question is, are you committed to fully implementing this law and fully funding it as well?
Well, before you respond to Zachary, we got an email from Doug, who I guess is a little more emotional than Zachary is about this. He says, paid family and medical leave passed the council by a huge margin and is supported by 80% of D.C. residents. When will you start implementing this policy instead of standing in its way?
I'm not standing in its way. And actually, I had the opportunity to veto the universal paid leave legislation. Everybody knows I have some significant concerns about it. But I believe that the council did overwhelmingly support the bill, and with fixes, it can be a very good policy in the District of Columbia.
What do you mean by fixes?
Well, I'll just say, since that time, there have been two replacement bills offered by the council. The chairman of the council has indicated that he would hold a hearing on those bills. So I'm not sure if this is going to be the final policy. I will remind the callers that the bill was passed subject to appropriation. So it actually goes into effect when the funds are put in place to pay for it. So our budget includes, it maintains what the council put in the budget last year was $20 million. The first thing that really needs to happen is the funding for the system, which ranges anywhere from $40 to $80 million, needs to be funded in this budget. And if it is, we stand ready. In fact, we have started the process of having a task force of executive branch employees to start figuring out what we need to do to get the system in place.
Tom Sherwin.
Well, you know, I was surprised that the council chairman, Phil Mendelson, aggressively over the last year allowed the council to vote on this. And then once it went up to the Hill, he said, well, we're going to relook at the funding for paid family leave. And it doesn't seem to be any progress on that. Is there going to be a hearing or something?
I recall him saying that there would be a hearing in June.
Just before the summer recess.
That's what I recall. So I expect, and the council can decide to move around this, you know, $20 to $60 million to put the funding in place in what they do.
And I think the chairman said on this program, or he said that he was concerned that you might use procedural methods to hold up any spending on paid family leave. And that's why one of the reasons I think he said that is why he was looking at maybe changing the funding so we'd still go fully ahead. But you're not doing anything to delay the implementation.
Yeah, and I think we talked the last time that I was here that and everybody should know that we're going to follow the law. And this has been a priority for the council, and they can fund it. And they can fund it with this budget. But I am encouraged that they are also looking at making the bill better. And I think if we can make the bill better, that would be good for all families and taxpayers in D.C.
We only have about a minute left.
Very quickly, you went to Casa Ruby, I think, today.
I did.
And new homelessness, despite everything the city does, continues to be a big problem. What were you doing today?
We were focusing on youth homelessness. Last week or a couple days ago, we talked about our point in time count, which is a day in January where we go out and we try to figure out where we to identify our homeless families and individuals. We saw, I think, a 20% drop in that point in time from the year before. We saw, and that was largely driven by a decrease in family homelessness. We saw less of a drop in unaccompanied youth, and we know that we got to stop treating our young people like little adults. They have specific needs, and we're going to be strategic about addressing them.
The other thing you did today, reliable sources inform us, is bike to work. Tom,
yes.
Sherwood feels that going down 16th Street is pretty easy. He wants to know
whether
or not.
I didn't say it was easy. I just said it
was
downhill.
He said it was easy. He said it was easy. He wants to know whether or not you're going to bike back uphill.
Well, actually, before I biked to work, I went to the November Project. And if you're not familiar with that, it's a fantastic group of Washingtonians that work out on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I met them at Chuck Brown Park, and that's where I biked to work from.
Okay.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Mayor Muriel Bowser, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Thanks, Tom.
Don't forget to meet us back here on Monday. D.C.'s looking into building a new jail, but no one seems to really want to talk about it. So, well, we're going to. We're also going to talk about the potential local impact of the Attorney General's push for harsher sentences for drug crimes. That's all at noon on Monday. Tom Sherwood, you have a pleasant weekend.
I intend to.
And until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandy.
The Kojo Nandy Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schroepsdorf, Ruth Tam, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Cliff Gallagher has been on the phones. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nandy Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.